Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So, people, have you heard about the high-profile terrorism trial taking place in open court in Brooklyn? No, you haven't? Well, you're not alone. This case actually hasn't received that much attention. Regardless, the jury is now deliberating in the trial of Adis Madunjanin, a 28-year-old who stands accused of being an al-Qaeda operative who was plotting an attack on the subway system in 2009. Convicted terrorists have testified in the case. Joining me now is Bob Henley, WNYC's contributing editor for Politics and Investigations. He's been following the case and just got back from a trip to the courthouse in Brooklyn this morning. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
What are the charges against the suspect? Do the prosecutors what do the prosecutors specifically say he did?
Well, specifically, they say that Madunjanin and Najibul Azizi and Zirin Ahmedzai, they were high school classmates in Queens. They are alleged to have traveled to Peshawar, Pakistan, and then on to Waziristan to an al-Qaeda camp where they received instruction in weapons, assembling weapons, taking them apart, in bomb assembling. And then the idea is they were – al-Qaeda's leadership basically said to them, according to the prosecution, you know, with your passports and access to America, you would be far better in terms of serving our need for global jihad to go back to the United States and be suicide bombers in the subway. And so that's where we do have in the case of – you know, Zazi and Ahmedzai have already pled guilty to charges and are hoping for some kind of dispensation or leniency from the government in exchange for prosecuting, you know, in exchange for helping the prosecution with, you know, the prosecution of Adis Madunjanin. And so, you know, that's where you have this dynamic here where he did not want to take the deal that the government offered. And as a result, he's facing this trial for. I mean, these are multiple charges, and he faces life in prison.
What are his versions of events?
Well, this is where you do have this the very contrasting narratives. His version is that he – well, first, keep in mind, I spoke with his sister this morning. He came up from Bosnia with his family as a Muslim when he was 9. So he had experienced the anxiety and fear that came with all we know that unfolded in Bosnia with the ethnic cleansing targeting Muslims. And then gradually, you know, in his 20s, he was concerned about what he was seeing coming back in footage from Afghanistan, which was considerable civilian collateral damage because of the war. And so his version of events is that he went over there in hopes of joining the Taliban to defend innocent civilian Muslims who he saw increasingly under attack from an occupying army. Of course, his former classmates say that he was in on it. And that he was going to be part of this suicide bombing plot. He is basically insisting and has had the benefit of a very good legal team to make his case that he did not want to be a suicide bomber and was not part of that aspect of the conspiracy.
That he went to the Taliban and had a
He was short-circuited. He had a romantic notion, and instead of finding the Taliban, found al-Qaeda.
Uh-huh.
And then did not want to – and there's apparently – the defense tried to make much of the fact that once they were in this training camp, there was a falling out between them – between the trio from Queens, with Adis getting, you know, roughed up a bit because he wasn't devout enough, and they didn't like the way that he was being religiously observant. So the defense tried to plant the notion that there was this kind of rift that was opening when they were in the training camp. However, the events that happened, we know that in September of 2009, Zazi got pulled over and by the police, the Port Authority, and the George Washington Bridge, and that started the public awareness of what was going on. And then, of course, the pressure continued. And then it was really not until, you know, go back to like 2010, that's when they're feeling the heat, if you will, of the ongoing investigation. And Madunjanin is under surveillance for quite a long period of time here, and at one point leaves his home and races at 90 miles an hour, and then
down the Whitestone Expressway, correct?
And creates a crash, and then he makes a 911 call before the crash, basically saying, this is Hadith, according to the tape, we love death more than you love life, which is an al-Qaeda battle cry. And so, of course, the defense says that this he was reacting to all the pressure he was under because of the government's prosecution of the case. But,
so he was trying to be a suicide car bomber on the Whitestone Expressway tipped off police in advance through this 911 call?
He was speeding at 90 miles an hour and then in a self-destructive rage, evidently. But, of course, like so much in this case, and this is why it's not comic, but it's hapless. The airbags deploy, so there is not the catastrophic loss of life that he had anticipated. He takes off across the median, and the FBI agent that is in pursuit of him convinces him to come back. And then there's a long interrogation here in Manhattan at the Joint Terrorism Task Force into 2 o'clock in the morning. And there's a lot of question about what happened during that interrogation. And that's where we see another division between what the defendant is saying, what the government's alleging.
This trial has seen several convicted terrorists who've been called upon to testify in the trial. Among them is Sajid Mohammed Badat, who was supposed to be the second shoe bomber, along with Richard Reed way back a decade ago. Right. Badat was arrested and imprisoned in Britain and then started cooperating with authorities there. What do we know about Badat and his testimony?
Well, the thing is that these things happen over a long period of time. The description of the al-Qaeda that these people encountered really varies widely. I mean, when the time that Badat was involved, you had crowded training camps. It was very different. You didn't have al-Qaeda so much on the ropes where, because of the drone attacks as described by the three from Queens, they didn't even want to go out during the daytime in the camp. So you have a much less robust al-Qaeda today. Also, interestingly enough, Badat's been released early in Britain. So we have a very different scenario here. So he's out and about for cooperating with the government.
Yesterday, as the jury began deliberations, defense attorney Robert Gottlieb took the opportunity to make a statement to reporters. We have a 15-second clip of this. You want to set it up?
Yeah, this is, of course, the jury deliberations is a sensitive period of time, and attorneys generally don't want to be out in the public making statements. But Gottlieb felt that it was important in light of the fact that we know Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's military tribunal is starting, and that's a very different kind of trial, if you will. It's not, you know, a civilian trial. There's not a jury. And he wanted to make the point that he felt that the jury's due diligence and the whole process illustrated that America's civil justice system could handle terrorism cases.
The message is this case and every case in this country, if we are true to our ideals, will be heard by citizens, verdicts decided by citizens, not in military commissions and secret tribunals or starred chambers. That's not what this country is about.
That's really a political statement wrapped up in the prosecution of an individual case.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have to say what's interesting throughout this trial is it really has looked very much like the Pedro Espada trial, which is also going on. That's the trial of former Majority Leader Pedro Espada, which is a white-collar
New York State Senate.
And you go between them, and there's really not a heavy militarized presence in either courtroom. And, I mean, in fact, this morning was the first time that I saw, bomb detection dogs or any heavy weapons. And, of course, with the anniversary of bin Laden, you can expect that.
Well, then let's turn back the clock for a moment to 2009, because there was a time when the Justice Department wanted to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in federal court in Manhattan, and we all remember how that turned out. There was so much pushback to the idea of having a terror trial in New York and having it be civilian with civilian court protections that the Obama administration flipped and decided that KSM would be tried at a military court at Guantanamo instead. And as you say, that's going to start next month. So now we're talking about a major terror trial happening in downtown Brooklyn, and it is hardly the first terror trial that's taken place in New York. What do we learn from the experience here? Or maybe there's no comparison. You say there doesn't seem to be much security presence.
It's subtle.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of fear that other terrorists are going to try to come and spring them or bomb the courthouse just to, you know, further the war because one of their colleagues is on trial there, whatever. But can you really draw a comparison between that and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, considering his stature? Did Mr. Gottlieb try?
I think that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, of course, is a top leadership individual And so you're right about that. It's not exactly apples to apples. But I will say the one advantage we get from having a civilian trial is you get an insight into how this kind of alienation that's happened on isolated occasions with individuals in America. I mean, I think that it's instructive to get a sense of how what all these young men have in common is that they were following Anwar al-Awlaki, the U.S.-born militant cleric who was executed by the United States through a drone attack in Yemen. You know, and what's interesting here is that even before 9/11, you had a lot of people saying who followed these matters that we were different than, say, France or London or, you know, the United Kingdom because we didn't have a stratified society where individuals could live in the country but have such diametrically opposed narratives about what's happening in the world. And what you do see in this terror trial is a degree to which America doesn't have quite the societal cohesion that we thought because right there in Queens, it's quite stunning to hear the names of places like Casino Park or Bear Mountain as part of a narrative for a criminal conspiracy where, again, this is what's unusual about this, Brian. I don't think we've said this. There was no government sting involved. So many of the cases we've seen with the federal government, it has been something where there was an informant or money or resources that were put in by the government to bring it to fruition. In this case, it wasn't.
So they can never claim entrapment.
Right. This is a case of volitional choices made by individuals, which is instructive.
I want to play another clip. And listeners, we have a few minutes left with WNYC's Bob Henley, who's been covering the trial, which has now gone to the jury in Brooklyn Federal Court of Adis Madunjanin, a 28-year-old who was accused of being an al-Qaeda operative plotting an attack on the subways in 2009. This is part of the questioning by the FBI of one of the other suspects who took the deal from the government, pleaded guilty, and flipped on his friend here, Najibul Azazi, where agents are questioning him about a scale that was found in his luggage.
So I don't know exactly how did it came in my luggage, but there was a scale. Surprisingly, okay. I found it in my car.
So if there was a scale in your luggage,
yeah.
You have no idea how it got there, correct?
That's correct.
What's the significance of the scale?
One of the things is that we have – there's a lot of – thanks to all the ubiquitous nature of video surveillance. There's tape of him going around and collecting all kinds of household beauty products that could be used, getting a myriad acid supply, all kinds of things to try to get his nitrogen fixed to do what he needed to do to create these bombs. What's fascinating is that he lost a page apparently of his – manual, the bombing manual, so they already had to downsize. It's instructive here, though, that you have a tape of the FBI because this came up as a central issue in the defense of Madunajin. One of the things is that there is apparently no tape of the hours and hours of marathon interrogation that happened here with the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force. The FBI agent in charge of that interrogation said it's policy not to have a tape. But there's a lot that's a contention here because the FBI says that during his debriefing, his marathon debriefing, Adis Madunajin said that he loved Osama bin Laden more than himself, that he wanted to kill American soldiers. And, of course, we don't have exactly what it was you played now. So we do have the contemporaneous notes of the FBI.
The New York Times reported a few weeks ago, though, that the prosecution has withheld much of their evidence from public view because it's classified. So is this a kind of model for how terrorism trials could unfold in civilian court? You can't see it. I can't see it. Our listeners can't hear it. But the jury can?
Well, certainly what's interesting, too, the other thing that's very different here is that this jury is anonymous. So and that's interesting to see what's going to happen after the trial if the jurors will give up their anonymity. But it was decided early on, Judge Gleason – decided to do that, to take that extra precaution. One of the things that this morning that the jury wanted to see, and I thought that I wanted to bring this up with you, is they asked for the FBI's 302s, which are the information reports the FBI makes out, and those weren't put into evidence, so the judge said that they couldn't have them. And then they also wanted to see, the jury wanted to see the cooperation agreement that Ahmadzai and Zazi signed. So that, you know, the lawyers were trying to parse that. this jury is also very male-dominated. It's 10 men to 2 women, for what it's worth.
Do you think that was for a reason?
No, I'm just saying it's the luck of the draw.
The jury, these 10 guys and 2 women, already asked for clarification yesterday about something and to see a piece of evidence, again, some phone records. You also went to the courthouse today to listen to the judge's answer to some of the jury's clarifying questions. What do we know?
Well, we know, like I just said, that the 302s are out, that they're focusing in on the cooperation agreement. There was some question about the cell phone records, whether or not there were pocket dials. Of course, the government's trying to show that it's like a Rorschach. You know, you look at an ink blot and you interpret it based on what your predisposition is. In this case, the government sees the cell phone records and sees evidence of collaboration even after they came back from the training camp. And that's important because the defense has been saying that there was an alienation and a falling out.
And, of course, this is all happening. And who knows, maybe there will be a verdict on the first anniversary of the killing of Osama bin Laden. You've been watching the president going around taking his victory lap.
It's a little troubling in the sense that I've had the same feeling when I saw Cory Booker after a very heroic act when he saved an individual from a fire. I think that when you've had thousands of Americans lose their lives and tens of thousands of civilians and $1.7 trillion spent, that it seems just odd to have the president do a victory lap on that. I don't know if John F. Kennedy, and maybe it has to do with the media cycle. I don't know. I can't imagine after the Cuban Missile Crisis, John Kennedy granting access and then reenacting it. There's something about it. You want to assume with your leaders that that's just what they do. And that's one of the strong suits the president has, is his coolness. And so just like with Cory Booker racing to, you know, go book Charlie Rose, I think he would have been better for himself long term just to say, hey, that's what I do, because firefighters and police do those things every day.
On the other hand, the president is trying to make a point while he makes the media rounds to acknowledge the first anniversary, for which maybe he can take some credit, that they're not having celebrations, they're not having parties, it's a solemn occasion, Americans risk their lives, many people have died in the wars. So he's trying to keep a certain decorum about it.
I think the idea of granting exclusive interviews to people to reenact it, I mean, I've seen the rushes where they're talking about where I was when it happened. I think of all the loss in this country with people that have lost individuals in those wars, and it's just something about maybe it was what the nuns did to me in school, Brian. I feel troubled by it.
All right. If you ran into your next door neighbor's house to save the family from a burning building and Charlie Rose called you up and said, gosh, you're WNYC's Bob Henley and you did this thing, come on our show.
No.
You turn him down?
I pass. That's not – that would just what you do as a human being. I don't know if that's something that you – you know, I hope I never find out. But, I mean, especially as a civil servant –
would you come on my show?
Probably not to talk about that. I mean, here's the thing. I think this is a character question. I think you look back at Cory Booker works very hard for the city of New York. And I'm just thinking as a media consultant – not that I am, and I don't play one on the radio. But how cool would it have been if he just had a regular press conference and said, yeah, I did that. Next.
WNYC's Bob Henley – covering the terror trial in civilian court in Brooklyn, now in the hands of the jury. Thank you very
much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, the last thing we will do today is take our last few minutes for our latest round of advice roulette. We've done this once before, and it was so much fun, we decided to take a few minutes and try it again. Here's how it works. Just call in and ask for advice on anything. In exchange, you have to give advice to one of your fellow listeners. It's that simple. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you'd like to participate in the second Brian Lehrer Show Advice Roulette. Think of one thing you need advice on and call in and ask for it. Now, since it's May Day, maybe you're thinking about your job and your labor situation, and you need some work-related or career advice, or it can be anything. Call us up. Ask your advice on that question from another of our listeners, 212-433-9692. And then we'll keep you on the line to offer advice to the next person on whatever they ask, and so on. And it doesn't have to be job-related. It can be about anything, relationship advice, help with an ethical quandary, advice about buying a bike, anything. Get advice, give advice, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, Advice Roulette, with us and your fellow Brian Lehrer Show listeners right after this.